Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right, including your movie.
Josh Bell hates everything.
Except me.
Hello and welcome to the Josh Bell Hates Everything podcast. I'm Josh Bell, film editor for Las Vegas Weekly. And joining me this week is film critic and historian Tony Macklin, author of the book Voices from the Set and online at tonymacklin.net. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, I hope.
I think it will be. I think this is a good because we're gonna kind of spotlight a couple really sort of, I guess you could say, legendary filmmakers in this edition, both of whom have new movies that are opening in Vegas theaters this week. Woody Allen and Clint Eastwood are the people that we're going to be talking about. And we'll start off with Woody Allen. His new movie is called You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger. And that opens this week. And I think this movie has gotten kind of less than stellar reviews. And I wouldn't argue that it's a great film. But I found it more entertaining than I expected that I would.
One of the problems, we've talked about this before, about reviewers, is they say, oh, it's not what I expected it to be, or it's not the way I want it to be, and therefore the director's lazy. I think it's a very good film.
Yeah.
I think the dialogue is good. I love that he uses great cinematographers, and many times that's missed in many of his best films. The cinematographer, Gordon Willis in Manhattan, Annie Hall, and in this one, he brings Vilmos Zsigmond, who shows us a London. The film is disconcerting because there's nobody to root for.
Yeah.
You root for them, but the characters who succeed, the few characters who succeed, are the most deluded.
Right.
And so his message or his vision is that dreams do not turn out as we think they will, and in fact, they fall apart.
Right. It's a very pessimistic film, and I think that's interesting that you're talking about there's no one to root for. I think that's maybe something that Allen has done more and more in his later films, is that his movies are now just full of these very, not even just flawed characters, but sort of misguided and in a way, bad people. And maybe that's his cynicism that comes more and more to the front.
Well, I don't think it's bad so much as fallible.
Yeah.
I wanted to root for Anthony Hopkins because I'm his age. I've got the same name.
Yeah.
We were both born in December, and his character is after
the hot younger woman.
A hot younger woman.
Right.
And it don't work out
the way he hopes it will. It doesn't. And I think that one of the things that Allen gets criticized for is things like that, like the older man, younger woman relationships. But I think in this movie, he's very much not shying away from the negatives of age or the things that weigh on people as they get older. He's not pretending to be a younger man here because, as you said, it doesn't work out between Anthony Hopkins and his younger woman. And every character who's sort of facing mortality in this movie does so seriously.
And great actors are very proficient actors, want to be in his film because he gives them dialogue that has depth or makes sense and
yeah.
is human and has a purpose.
Right. Yeah, and there are a lot of great. I mean, Naomi Watts, I think, is really excellent in this film. And Anthony Hopkins is good. I mean,
And Gemma Jones
right.
is excellent, and she was in one of my favorite TV shows, MI5.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah, it's well acted. I think Frida Pinto from Slumdog Millionaire, who plays a supporting role, is a little shaky, but overall it's well acted. I think it does recycle a bit of some of the stuff that Allen has done in other movies.
But great directors have a vision and a point of view that they repeat.
Right, and he certainly
does
that.
You hope it advances it.
Yeah.
And we're further into the abyss in this film.
We are, that's true. I mean, and I think that he's facing that is something that's interesting about this movie.
And those of you who want to celebrate Woody's birthday, he will be 75 December 1st.
Oh, there
we
go.
So we can have a Woody Allen party.
That's wonderful. We're having a Woody Allen party right now. So let's talk about, I think we can agree that while this is a good movie, it's certainly not one of his best movies. But Allen is incredibly prolific and has made dozens of films over the years, good and bad. So I guess if you had to pick just one, what would be your top Woody
See,
Allen film?
I can't
film?
Do that. I can probably do it a little better with literature.
Yeah.
But like a Hitchcock film, one day it's Vertigo, the next day it's another Hitchcock, Strangers on a Train. And it's the same way with Eastwood and Woody Allen, that I don't have one that always bubbles to the top.
Right.
I have like five or like I have five or six films. I really like films that people don't know occasionally. Interiors,
yeah,
which was a Bergman-esque, very social. I mean, he is a social critic.
Right.
I'm a social critic.
Yeah.
So that one really spoke to me. Crimes and Misdemeanors, I love that because good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people, and I know that well.
Right, yeah. I agree. I love Crimes and Misdemeanors a lot, and I think that's a great balance between Allen's humor and the serious – something like Interiors I think was almost a little too self-consciously heavy.
I wouldn't recommend Interiors to a person that's not – that doesn't have a bleak vision, but I loved it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I do have a bleak vision, but I think what I like about Crimes and Misdemeanors is that you get that bleak vision with a dash of his humor, which is also often very bleak.
I've always had a fond spot for one of his first that – he didn't direct. Herbert Ross directed Play It Again, Sam.
Yeah.
I think that's a funny film. And that's the beginning Woody that was – there was a certain innocence or a certain naivete to him. But that I would put in my top five.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen that. And I think I started seeing – when I started seeing Woody Allen movies was – obviously much later on in his career. And so the sort of earlier, funnier pictures, as they say in Stardust Memories, I didn't come to until later. And a lot of those I haven't seen. But something like Sleeper, for example, that's very slapsticky. Bananas. Those are less of my sort of wavelength for Woody Allen.
Mine too. I don't think those particularly succeeded. We have to mention Annie Hall.
Of course.
And Annie Hall, one of the fascinating things about that is, do you know why it's titled Annie Hall?
Isn't that the character's name? Am I crazy?
That's the character's name, but it's also Diane Keaton's real name.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
I did not know that.
And it what that film does so interestingly is it compares and contrasts the West and the East,
right?
Hollywood and New York,
yeah.
And of course Woody favors the
New
East.
York always wins, yes.
As some of us thoughtful folk do,
right? Yeah, no, I mean, and I love Annie Hall. I think from that same era, I mean, Manhattan is probably my favorite of his films. And you were talking earlier about the cinematography, and obviously Manhattan is one of the most gorgeous films.
And Gershwin's score is wonderful. It captures Woody's New York.
Right, and I think that's one of Woody Allen's best performances, and it just works on all levels. And I will stand up, too. I think the movies that he's made in the last, 20 years or so have been often considered lesser works, but I think a lot of those movies are really good too. Sweet and Lowdown from, I think it's from 99, is a very different kind of movie for him. It's a biographical picture with a really great performance from Sean Penn. I think Match Point from just a few years ago, when we're talking about Crimes and Misdemeanors, and Match Point is very more serious than that and very, very bleak, but I think it's a really successful examination of that kind of vision.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Yeah.
I think is a wonderful film.
I agree. And I think he maybe doesn't get quite enough credit for some of those later films that...
Again, it's the dopey reviewers who don't understand that a person evolves.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what a lot of people feel about Woody Allen is that he hasn't evolved, is that he's sort of spinning his wheels on a lot of these films. And I can see that. And certainly there are a lot of ones that are not good.
They haven't evolved as viewers.
Wow. But I mean, of course, you wouldn't argue that every one of his films of the last decade or so is worthwhile or
is
a good
film. Oh, of
course
I would. That's my basic point of view. No, I would not argue that.
Right. And so I think it's
I think you can be critical, but you have to be informed.
Right.
And you have to understand what the director is trying to do, not what you think he should do or what you want him to do, but what he is doing.
Right.
And does he do it?
Right, right. But I think even in that case, some of the recent movies that he's made have failed. But I think the thing about Woody Allen and why I'm always eager to see a new movie, even if word on it in advance is that it's not very good, is that he does always have something to say. He always is Woody Allen, and I like that about him.
Do you know how few people listen to the language of a film, the dialogue, the scripts.
Yeah.
Most people don't pay any attention to the dialogue. And Woody's dialogue is spot on.
Yeah. No, it definitely is. And I think the fact that he gets such good actors to say that dialogue really, it grabs you. It pulls you in. Or any other?
No, that's all right.
So from a director known for his writing and his dialogue to a filmmaker and actor who's known for his sort of stoicism, I guess you could say, Clint Eastwood, who, like Woody Allen, is known as an actor and a director. His new film is called Hereafter. And I guess we could argue that this is sort of a departure for Eastwood as a director, taking on this sort of metaphysical mumbo jumbo. I think he usually is better at the sort of more grounded, real, here's people in their everyday lives kind of trying to make it through.
At the beginning of the decade, I thought Clint had probably run his course. And I thought that Space Cowboys in 2000, in the year 2000, would be a nice farewell. And then suddenly this new spirit was born. And not only was it new, but it was brave.
Yeah.
He took chances with Million Dollar Baby, with Letters from Iwo Jima. Can you imagine a film from the Japanese point of view?
Right.
And then last year, Invictus really disappointed me because I thought Mandela was perfect for him. And yet the film was listless. There wasn't any energy. It was bloodless.
It was very
formulaic. And so I went to this film and Hereafter expecting, oh boy. And then the first sequence is startling, and it's really effective. Tsunami is wonderful, but that's by far the best thing in the film. I asked myself, why is Clint making this movie? I mean, he's 80 years old, yes. He might be looking into the hereafter, but he's a better director a better visionary than just that. I don't know what convinced him about making this film. Maybe there's something, it does have dualities. It has my favorite twos. There are two teddy bears. There's twins. There are two brothers. There are two women that are TV hosts. And there's the sense of, but it has no mystery.
Right.
The film has no mystery. And as I said in my review, his mentor, Don Siegel, would look at that and say, did you turn gay at the end of your life?
Oh.
No, I mean.
Don Siegel, vulgar.
Don Siegel would say it was a director who was terse and succinct,
right,
and got it told. And Clint, right, in all his films was, and in this, he's floating in the clouds.
Right.
And I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I was very, very disappointed by this outing.
Yeah. I mean, I was too. I think I'm not as big a Clint fan, not that I dislike him in any way, but I think I'm not as invested in his work maybe as you are. And so
the funny thing is I'm not that much of a fan. He's not my favorite director. I think he's interesting. I taught a college course on him, had an interview with him, as you know.
Right.
And there's something about, we were talking about evolving, the evolution. And I've always said, as long as he lives, I have something to follow, and that I'll still live, and keep going, Clint. Being active, and keep being courageous, and keep being bold. And then he comes up with this kind of gaspy film, or gassy film, and wow.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I definitely didn't care for this film, and I think the thing about Eastwood is as a director is that he's known for being so quick. You know, just doing a few takes of everything and having this almost light touch kind of just coming in and getting it done, that if he's working with a script that isn't all there, then he's not going to bring it to a higher level necessarily.
By the way, I'm worried about what I said previously.
Okay.
Don Siegel may have said gay, but Clint and I wouldn't. Clint said made it in the Garden of...
In the Garden of Good and Evil? Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Midnight in the Garden of Evil. So we are pro...
I understand that.
We are anti...
I understand
Don't tell,
that.
don't...
I understand don't tell. I understand but. That. And then, I mean, I think it's interesting, even though Clint is known for being this very macho guy, especially as a performer, but also as a filmmaker, I think it's interesting for him to take on something softer and something a little more metaphysical. But
what is so interesting is that both Woody Allen and Clint Eastwood are women's directors. In their part, they have great parts for women. They understand in a certain way as much as a man can, which is 30% maybe. But they seem to really, I mean, for this man who Pauline Kael called the Dirty Harry a fascist film,
right,
to make films like Million Dollar Baby or films that have women who are strong and human and fascinating,
right,
those are two directors that often get attacked as being not
right
conducive to, they're conducive to pulchritude, we know that, but they're also conducive to the, they're also interested in women's souls.
Yeah, I mean, and this movie is obviously one of the three main characters. There's Matt Damon, who plays a psychic, and the little boy who is trying to deal with the death of his twin brother, and then Cécile de France, the French actress, plays TV journalist in France.
Boy, does she stare a lot. She stares.
Everybody in this movie stares. This movie could be called Staring the Movie.
It's, well, also, there are shots that are lengthy that you say, Clint, you and Don would have cut this,
yeah,
maybe thrown the scene out.
Yeah.
But you certainly wouldn't have cut it and would have cut it and not extended it till to Yonville.
Everything. I mean, this whole movie, I think, is just so lugubrious and so plodding. And then you wait and you wait. And it's one of these movies where there's three separate stories and you're waiting for them to connect. And you think maybe eventually there's going to be some revelations or there's going to be some connections here that justify all this time spent with nothing. And there's nothing at the end.
Well, after the first 15 minutes, did you think it was going to be a good film?
No, I didn't. I didn't think it was going to be a good film. But I was still hoping because, again, I think Eastwood is a talented guy.
Now, how about the first sequence? You didn't like it as much as
I
did.
I mean, it's not that I didn't like it as much as you did. Yeah. I didn't dislike it, but I was sort of – I felt like as the longer the movie went on and the more I realized it didn't really have anything worthwhile to say, the more it annoyed me that they used the tsunami as well as the London bombings to tell this sort of hacky story, and they use these real serious disasters as lame shorthand for something that they're not able to actually get across themselves. And that annoys me.
Now, don't give up yet, because Clint's next film, the one he's making right now, is about J. Edgar Hoover.
Yes, and that seems like a much better subject matter for him. I think hopefully that'll be good, and I'm glad that he's still making movies. So let's talk about some better Clint Eastwood films. And I know you're not going to want to name one favorite, but what are some of your favorite Clint Eastwood films?
One of my favorite, and I keep going back to it, is In the Line of Fire, which he didn't direct.
Yeah.
But he was one side of the character, my duality.
Right.
And John Malkovich made a wonderful villain, and Rene Russo made a fine love interest. It was directed by Wolfgang
Peterson. Right? Yeah.
And that was one of my favorite. I think Dirty Harry has held up really, really well.
Yeah.
And I've taught that. And it does have layers. It does have levels. It was socially shocking when it came out in 71. But I think that has endured. So that's two. The Beguiled has always been one of my favorite because nobody knows it. Like,
right.
It's a secret pleasure for me where Clint plays a soldier, wounded soldier during the war between the states who is taken into a girls' school.
I think that's an interesting movie because Clint is not playing a good person in that movie. He's not really
not at all
heroic
not
in any
all.
Way. And I think that's unexpected for people.
I think Clint always, from the very beginning, had this idea of myth and reality and anti-myth. And certainly it came to total fruition with Unforgiven.
Right.
Where money, the protagonist, is certainly
you don't
not
want to
a
call
hero.
Him a hero, yeah.
But that, in a sense, ended the Western. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were still Westerns, But that was, in a sense, the final major statement that we've had in American film about the Western.
Right. No, and I love Unforgiven. I haven't seen nearly as many Eastwood movies as you have, but I have actually seen all those that you've mentioned. Some of the thanks to you, especially The Beguiled. But yeah, I love In the Line of Fire was probably the first Clint Eastwood movie I ever saw, and when I was a teenager, and it's just a really exciting thriller,
and it's well done. You can go back and see it, and there are things going on in it. It has a wonderful script, wonderful direction, wonderful performance. It's just a first-rate movie.
Yeah,
this is another director who has taken chances. We were talking about Alan.
Yeah,
you were talking about the Swing Low
Swing Low. Yeah,
and he made Bird, which is Charlie Parker
Forest
Whitaker.
Right.
And that was part of his jazz. And he also made a film that really didn't work, but it was one of those that you say, boy, I guess it's interesting. White Hunter, Black Heart, where he portrayed a John Huston-like figure.
Right.
And it was – it's part of his au revoir.
Right, And I haven't seen those, but I think – that is something that's valuable about Eastwood as a director, is that he does seem to want to try new things and go into different genres. And even if we see something like Hereafter that we can say, well, that's didn't
work.
Yeah, but
see, he hadn't made crap yet. So he decided to do Hereafter.
I don't know. I think actually the Hereafter is probably the worst of them. But some of Eastwood's recent films, I mean, we mentioned Invictus, which is pretty lifeless. And I thought Changeling was kind of a mess.
See, I like Changeling. Yeah. I thought he succeeded in Changeling what he tried to do here. He has always avoided sentimentality. In Changeling, he went right up to the brink of sentimentality. In this film, he gets drowned in sentimentality.
That's all sentimentality, yeah. But so I don't know. I think even in those – and Eastwood is so famous and so well-regarded that any actor seems like they're sort of falling over themselves to work with him. Which is great. So he gets these big budgets and he gets these great actors. But I think sometimes maybe he would do well to take a step back and get a second draft on the script in some cases, because I think that just the story isn't there in some of these movies.
But he's always been able to write to direct out of work that is Pulp Fiction or very close. It's genre.
Yeah.
So it's not elevated writing. But you're right that this is a fumbling script. It's personal by Peter Morgan because he had somebody in his life who died. So he turned to the Hereafter and said, what am I here for? Well, not to make movies right now.
See, and I think Peter Morgan has done better too. And I was looking forward to something by Peter Morgan because I think he's a good writer. But in both cases, I think this is the wrong material for both Morgan and Eastwood, that just doesn't work for them. But
what is interesting is the first barrage of criticism of reviewers trying to get quoted, like what has happened to Roger Ebert? He's trying to get back after the illness. He's trying to get back to the top. So he's got a program. If your program is Josh hates everything, it's he loves everything. This is the best film I saw today, says Roger Ebert, and he's quoted in the ads. And all of the others who seem to be, you were talking about being fans of Clint, who are fans more than critics in their reviews.
Sure.
And then now on Rotten Tomatoes, I think it's dropped to 50%.
Yeah.
Because critics.
I think there's a lot of goodwill for Eastwood, and he deserves it. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff to warrant that goodwill. But yeah, I mean, that was the way I felt about Gran Torino, which I didn't care for. And I felt like it was so Clint being Clint-y that everyone was just so happy to see him do that that they gave him too much of benefit of the doubt.
No, I thought that was a fond farewell.
Yeah.
We were talking about critics, and I had it. Oh, and I lost it.
All right. Well,
I had a Hereafter moment.
There you go. You're seeing the afterlife in front of you. Well, actually, that's probably about all the time we've got, unfortunately. I mean, I'm sure we could spend forever talking about Clint Eastwood and Woody Allen as well.
And movies.
And movies.
And film.
Really anything. We could just sit here and
life itself.
But we have to stop. But thank you very much, Tony Macklin, for joining me this week. And for Las Vegas Weekly, I'm Josh Bell.
Josh Bell hates everything!